campaign, my father invited FDR to come down and recuperate at our house at the beach. My mother was going to Europe, and she left me in his care. We had a very close and loving relationship, but as my mother pointed out on her return, he was not really interested in how often I changed my underwear and so forth and so on. But nevertheless, it was a very carefree summer. And FDR accepted and came down. This presented more problems than might immediately appear. Although FDR had gotten on his feet to make the Happy Warrior speech, it was still extremely difficult for him to get around. He had braces that he sort of had to manipulate, and he had crutches, and he had canes. And he could walk a few steps on a platform, but he certainly couldn't go up and down stairs or anything like that. The Howe Cottage on the beach was a long way from the very ultra-civilized Roosevelt House in Campobello. All three of those cottages were very similar in appearance. They're of a kind that were very common in Westport before the 1938 hurricane, particularly along the shore. A simple frame building, a porch all around it, two stories, shingles over the frame, resting on posts driven into the sand. It had originally been built right on the edge of the ocean, but the beach had built out into a sort of a little rounded point in front of it, so it was about 100 feet from the high water. A small barn had been turned into a workshop and a one-bedroom cottage, overflow cottage. There was no road to it. The only way you could get out to it was along the beach, unless you wanted to walk over the dunes, and that was even harder than walking along the beach. The house had a living room across the front and two back rooms, one a dining room, one a kitchen with a kerosene stove, four bedrooms upstairs, one bedroom, all the bedrooms open, all but one, which had a plank ceiling, which gave a sort of a minimal amount of privacy. The other three bedrooms were open to the vault, so that every sound in every room echoed through the other two. The whole surrounded, as I say, by a wide plank porch. There was no electricity, so we had no running water. We pumped by hand out of the sink. No electric lights, used kerosene lamps, no furnace. Well, of course, this was summer. We never lived there in the winter. Had a fireplace and a kerosene cook stove. No bathroom, had an outhouse. And wash stands, which were put to, they weren't fancy things where you put the liquor in. They were very essential parts of the bedroom. No ice, no radio. And there was no road. It was half a mile from the end of Main Road, and we got, as I remember it, we got Henry Plant. Some of you who lived here before the hurricane may remember that Plant ran the pavilion. It had formerly been Miss Wise's cottage at the end of Main Road, and they'd bought it and turned it into a little bathing bathhouse place with a hot dog stand and lobster sandwiches and so forth. And Henry Plant was the adolescent eldest son of the family, and he had a Model T Ford, and he drove FDR out. And Charlie Hammond came out occasionally with his horse and wagon, and later with his Model T truck to deliver the groceries. Otherwise, all the errands, including picking up the mail, involved walking a mile and a half up to the post office in the middle of Westport, middle of the point, and bringing the groceries back in an express wagon, which you dragged along the beach. It was all right at low tide, but I can tell you at high tide, I got awfully tired of that express wagon. I was 12 years old. And as I say, I'd been left in my father's hands. My father fixed up the house a little for FDR, put planks laid down so that his wheelchair could be moved down to the beach and around the various parts of the ground floor. And I guess they had to carry him upstairs. His valet came with him, absolutely essential, because he had to be lifted in and out of everything, in and out of the wheelchair, upstairs to the bedroom. And while he could be wheeled down to the beach, once he got down there, you either carried him down to the water, or he could sort of crab-like walk on hands and knees, well, mostly on his legs are paralyzed. His upper part of his body was perfectly all right. His legs had no muscles to them. There they spent, my recollection is that it's a month, and I haven't found any confirmation of that. We had a tent down on the edge of the beach, below just at high tide there, where we could sit out of the sun, and there FDR spent most of the day, and he would go down into the water. I think this is where he really began to feel that salt water, or water in general, was a help to him. You know that later on, he went a great deal to Warm Springs in Georgia, where he could swim. And he was just learning to how he was going to rebuild those muscles which had been destroyed. He and my father were, theoretically, this was their excuse, they had to have some excuse, was theoretically working on a movie script. It was going to be The Life of John Paul Jones. Both of them had always been fascinated by John Paul Jones. Of course, as I say, they'd both been in the Navy Department. And this was particularly an interest of FDR. And my father, I remember, made a shadow puppet theater for me with John Paul Jones and the ships and so forth against a little white screen. We even had a script writer there for a while, who was supposed to be taking down this wonderful script. And I don't know whether the script is hidden away in some drawer at the Roosevelt Library at Hyde Park or not. I'd be interested in seeing it. I don't know how far they ever got on it. They were really there to recuperate. Elliot Roosevelt, the second son, was my playmate. And we went clam digging and, of course, surf bathing, rowing skiffs in the river. Model boats were built. My father and FDR each had a model boat. We had FDR gave a cup. He called it the Cromelbo Cup because that's the name of the bend in the river where the Hyde Park estate of the Roosevelts was. 36 inches. Later on, I think it was the next year, we raced them across the Hudson, and I'm happy to say that the Hyde boat beat the Roosevelt boat. My father was a better naval architect than you might have thought. The picture in my mind, as I say, nobody told me I was experiencing the last years of private life of a future president, governor and president. So I didn't write anything down. But my picture primarily, things that stick in my mind are that tent with the ocean right at your feet outside there and sort of lolling around down there. And then at the end of the afternoon, FDR always shook up an orange blossom. And not that I had orange blossoms, needless to say. And this was the time when everybody sort of got together and relaxed. FDR was a great storyteller. He absolutely loved to tell stories, and there were an endless supply of them, if only I'd written them down. Well, there's one story that I can remember, and I probably at least half of you have heard it, because it's by no means a unique to FDR. I heard him later tell it in the White House, and I'm sure he told it many, many times. And it's an old chestnut, which I last heard this past spring at the on a Bob and I record, told in almost the same way that Roosevelt told it. And it goes something like this. There was a whaling captain out of Nantucket, and he was particularly proud of his navigational skills. And one time they're coming back from a 3-year whaling voyage, and they were feeling their way up in a thick Nantucket fog somewhere off the banks there. And they're casting the lead. And the old man wasn't feeling well, and he stayed down. The first mate had the job of conning her in, but the captain was very worried because, as you probably know, there are a lot of shoals around Nantucket, and a heavy fog is not the best time to come in there. So they cast the lead every half hour, and she began to shoal up, and the captain demanded that the lead be brought down to him. Now, the captain was particularly proud of his skill. He knew every foot of the bottom within a 200-mile range. I wouldn't know a 200-mile, but as far as you could, within shoal water range of Nantucket. And he swore that he could tell exactly where the ship was by the, you know, Gillette had a little cavity, a cave in the hole in the bottom, which you filled with grease. And when you cast the lead and it went down to the bottom, it picked up whatever was on the bottom, whether it was mud or sand or gravel, clam shells, whatever, and brought it up, and that showed you what kind of a bottom you were going over. And the captain swore he knew to a foot. Well, not a foot. Well, anyway, half a mile, what part of the shoals off Nantucket he was on, but by what was in the grease on the bottom. And the mate got awfully tired of taking it down to him, getting us a little lecture about how to tell where you were in a fog. So the first mate and the second mate got together, and this was sort of, you know, whale ships were a little homier than clipper ships. They had a window box outside the deckhouse there that they filled with good Nantucket dirt before they left and had a little flower, a couple of plants in it. So they took the lead and they greased it up and they dipped it in the window box and they took it down to the captain. And they sat there with a grin on their face watching him getting ready to tell them where they were off Nantucket. The captain took it and he smelled it and he felt it in his hands. And he said, "My God, something terrible's happened. The whole island of Nantucket is sunk and we're right over my Aunt Maria's garden." Well, I can't tell as well as FDR could. But this was a favorite story, and this was typical of this wonderful end-of-the-day relaxation which even a 12-year-old kid could appreciate. I remember one time he came with a long discussion. This stuck in my mind because of later events. He came and talked about the dream he'd had the night before. He dreamt that he was in Windsor Castle and he was meeting the Queen of England, and he gave a long, long discussion, a description of his conversation with Her Majesty. And of course later on he met the kings and queens of England, as it were, and I don't know if he ever remembered his dream about that some 10 or 12 years before. Now this was 24, and toward the end of that summer we had a big storm. It came up the coast from the Carolinas, and it was the biggest storm I'd ever seen. I'd been there every summer since I was born. The waves came right up to the foot of the dunes in front of the house, and when they came back, they were 10-foot high backwash. I was absolutely scared stiff, I must say. Winston Stevens came, who lived in the house next door, the second one of the cottages, came over to say that the radio was reporting islands and beaches and cottages washed away off Cape Hatteras and all the way up the coast. And, well, my father said those islands were much more exposed than we were. There had never been a storm that was ever going to do anything up in New England. Everybody knew that. There hadn't been a storm there since 1844. And Anna Roosevelt, I remember saying, "It ain't going to rain no more," which was a very popular song in those days. We were very carefree, except me, who was scared. And eventually the storm went away, of course. But I've often wondered, what would you have done if the 1938 hurricane had it come up instead of the 1924 one, which was probably by that time 70 miles out to sea. We just got the little fringe of it. How could we have carried a helpless man across the dunes? Because in 1938, that house was washed over. The dunes around it disappeared completely. The house and the two cottages, the little tiny garage and cottage next to it, were washed away into the cranberry bog behind us and laid like that. And the waves went all the way up to the back row of dunes, which separates it from the woods behind Tripp's boatyard there. And we had maybe two or three strong people and two or three little kids to look after, including me. And what would we have done if that 6 o'clock on that day, as if 6 o'clock in 1938, it had started coming in over the edge of the front and washing around the foot of the cottage? Next summer, the Roosevelts rented a house next door. And later on, FDR went to Marion, where there was a doctor who helped him, and for several summers he rented a house there. I should add that in that second summer, Mrs. Roosevelt taught me how to swim. I've always thought that was a nice gesture, and I certainly appreciated it. I was a lousy swimmer. I'm not very good now, but at least I'm better than before she started. From Westport, FDR and Louis Howe went on together on the road that led eventually to the governor's mansion in Albany, and in 1932, of course, to the White House. I should say that Westport was apparently unimpressed by their visitor, who later became widely known. In 1932, Hoover carried the town by 304 votes. In 1936, Lanton carried Westport by 196 votes. In 1940, Wendell Willkie carried Westport by 155 votes. And in 1944, Dewey led by 361 votes. I assume that's because most of the young men of Westport were away in the Army at that time, and they were the predominantly Democratic voters in the town at that time. As far as I know, Louis Howe and Franklin Roosevelt were never again in Westport together after those two summers. That is, until a last visit in April 1936, when a presidential train brought my father home for burial in the Oak Grove Cemetery in Fall River, and with FDR and along with him to see him to his last resting place. The house and the beach and the dunes and anything except the tree on the back dune outside my bedroom window, which is still sitting up there, everything else was destroyed in the hurricane of 38. And I walked out there this spring, and I've walked out there several times, and it wasn't anything. But this spring, splinters of wood are beginning to come up through the sand, and some cable, which I think was the strut of the electric light pole that brought the light we had electricity later on. And little bits of glass from all the windows and drinking glasses and everything else in the house that worked their way up on the open beach. And there's this little scattering of debris, and that's all there is. And that's the end of the story. Tripp, I think, who had been one of the selectmen at that time, and Josie Stevens, who lived in the house next door, Winston Stevens's house on the beach, and Charlotte Fitch, who was a girl on the point and remembered trying to sell a Veterans Day poppy to FDR, which he failed to do. He said he already had one. I wonder if anybody here has.
You must have been pretty familiar with this area, other than Westport.
I don't know how often he came up. He certainly knew about this area, and he had Delano relatives who were quite close to him. I talked about the Delano at the very beginning.
Ask about the breakwater. When we used to sail out of the harbor in our little boat, there's a breakwater over there, an old one that doesn't prove anything now, but we understood then that that was connected with the times when Roosevelt was up here. Is that true?
Well, there's been a breakwater there all since the early years of the century. A pile of, we call it a pile of rocks. And it had eroded away and dropped into the channel, and the beach had cut in behind it. And when my father was in Washington, at the request of the selectmen, it became a public works project to restore a point of rocks out at the edge of, which in theory was to keep the end of the of Horseneck Point from eroding away. Of course, as you all know, what has happened is the beach has built out beyond the point of rocks and buried the rocks. And the sand, of course, is working out, is gradually working its way across the channel. But that was a PWA project, or else the Army Engineers, I'm not sure which. Yeah? I went to a meeting once, a political meeting in New York in the 50s, where I had the job of introducing Mrs. Roosevelt, and I said that my principal recollection of her in my childhood was that she made the best jelly sandwiches of anybody I ever knew. And that was a Westport recollection, because we frequently went up and picnicked around the end of the point where that little Beach. And I had a boat there, and we had a skiff, and we rowed around. That's where she taught me how to swim. And I knew Mrs. Roosevelt from my earliest childhood. And I knew her, of course, after her husband's death. And my admiration for her increased constantly over the years. It was, her relationship to my father was a very interesting one, I think. He was determined to keep FDR interested in life and interested in politics. And as part of this program, I guess you'd call it, he got Mrs. Roosevelt to become interested in politics. She'd never been politically minded. This was in the 20s. And he got her, and of course they passed the 19th Amendment, 18th Amendment, 19th, whatever it was that gave the votes to women. So that by this time women were entering politics, and she became active in the New York State Democratic Committee, and she went around and made a lot of political speeches. And as you may know, she had been an extremely shy person and a rather poor speaker. She had a voice that broke, a very high-pitched voice, and she had to take lessons to bring it down. But my father sort of pushed her into this and encouraged her to do it. And they ultimately became very close. They were allies in bringing FDR back into the world of political activity. They were very close friends. And in a certain, to a certain extent, again, they were complementary to each other. Eleanor Roosevelt was an extremely idealistic person, more so than her husband, and about 20 times as idealistic as my father, I can say offhand. My father was extremely practical, and he believed in that politics is the art of the practical. Mrs. Roosevelt was, as I say, an idealist, an extremely warm-hearted and sensitive person. She'd had a rather unhappy childhood. She was sensitive to the unhappiness of others. And she played a large part in sensitizing her husband to the human side of the Depression, that it was more than a matter of economics, it was a matter of human misery. My father was by no means an insensitive person, don't misunderstand me. He was an extremely sensitive person. He loved to paint, he loved music. But at the same time, he was an extremely practical politician. And if Mrs. Roosevelt's plans or proposals did not appear to him to be potentially achievable, he didn't hesitate to say so. So as I say, in a sense, he's presented the two aspects of the New Deal, the idealistic and the practical. They were complementary. Later on, Mrs. Roosevelt, I think after FDR's death, played an extremely important role in the continued sensitizing of the Democratic Party, that it didn't go back to being just a racetrack kind of a party, by which I mean that it didn't become a party in which the achievement of office was the major goal, but it remained a party in which the achievement of a set of principles was desirable. And she, in a sense, was the conscience of the Democratic Party until her death. I saw her off and on until her death. She came up here when my mother died, went to my mother's, she's buried in Oak Grove Cemetery too. And she was really a magnificent person. I don't know if you know her background and what a difficult life she had as a child and with her family. Her father was an alcoholic, and she was sort of sent away. She was a very plain, awkward, inverted child, not outgoing, inverted in that sense, and married to a person who was just the opposite. It was not easy. It was not easy. And she grew out of it. Her whole life was one of growth. I think that was true of her husband, too, which is one of the remarkable things. Isn't everybody keeps on growing after they're 30, I think. Yeah?
I remember the day your father was buried in the Oak Grove Cemetery, because I lived right across the road.
Oh, yes.
And there was quite a crowd there waiting to see the procession and the president.
I remember my dad told us
and what?
his name was. Now, Roosevelt was there too, I don't remember. But one thing he said, he always remember your dad saying, and I wish Eleanor would keep her damn mouth shut. And he thought that was really funny.
My father was, as I say, was a practical man, and sometimes Mrs. Roosevelt's idealism was difficult for him to cope with. Yeah.
What happened to the property?
Oh, I pay taxes on it every year.
You still own it now?
I still own it. I can't find it, but I still own it. And most of it's underwater because the beach is cut back. And the house, as I say, was 100 feet from the bank of the dunes, 100 feet back from it. And the dune, the high water line is now behind the remains, the little splinters that are coming up are behind it.
Is the town beach here next to Butter?
No. Where the cottage is, the Stevens Cottage, Brighton Cottage, Davis and Turner were in between. So it's about an eighth of a mile to the west of the town beach. There's a gap in it. Who owns that now? I have no idea. Maybe the Stevens is still on it. As I say, Josie Stevens is still a resident of Westport. She married a Davis boy from the cottage next door, and she lives down on Drift Road. And last time she was good enough to come and tell what she remembered about FDR. Any other comments? Well, I thank you for your patience, your fortitude in coming out on such a lovely day to sit indoors and listen to somebody talk.